Folks, and welcome to e-learning with E2R. Your panelists, as it were, for today are Aaron and Stuart. Welcome, and as you are probably aware, our topic today is workplace investigations, the costs of getting it wrong, and how to get it right. It is about as topical as it can get because workplace investigations are now a very, very fundamental part of how you manage, let's call it complaints that arise in the workplace. But before we get started, as we always do, here are a few reminders. If you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We will do our best to answer them during the presentation, but if we don't get a chance to answer in the moment, we will reach out afterwards to schedule a call to speak with one of our advisors. In case you missed one of our past webinars, apart from shame on you, you can find the recordings over on e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentation can be found on your member portal. Lastly, we take the opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is by way of overview only, not intended as a specific analysis of this given situation, and so we ask that you not rely upon it as legal advice for your situation. As always, contact us for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and for specific applicability of this topic area to your workplace. Our next e-learning with E2R will take place when it's getting hot on June 21st. So now, without further ado, let's get started. As we always do, we give you our agenda so we can take you through the roadmap of our discussion. So we have a packed plate today, but I think what you will find by the time we've completed this is you will get a very good sense of how important, number one, investigations are, and number two, the fact that investigations must be conducted properly because the consequences of any deficiencies are significant. So by way of agenda, we're going to talk about the purpose of an investigation. Then we're going to talk about the legal obligation or the duty to investigate, and specifically with respect to Bill 132, which is the recent amendment to the Ontario Occupational Health and Safety legislation. We will then go into getting it wrong. No better way to go through the myriad of consequences wherein you can get it, approaches that can result in you getting it wrong than doing a top 10 mistakes. And we'll provide you with case law examples to illustrate what can occur. We'll then try to get more positive by focusing on how to get it right. And we have a checklist. Everybody likes checklists. We're going to talk about determining if an investigation is appropriate in the circumstances. We will then frame the investigation once a determination is made to undertake an investigation. Selecting the appropriate investigator, and there are specific requirements for those organizations governed federally under the Canada Labor Code. We will then discuss how to prepare for the investigation, how to review the evidence, what needs to occur for purposes of the preparation of the investigation report, determining the outcome, you, the company, as judge and jury, and then informing the relevant parties of the result, and then, as always, we'll have some closing thoughts.
So what's the purpose of an investigation other than we're telling you to do more work? Because that's what we love to do. We like to add more and more onto your plates, onto your already busy days. Well, that's actually not the case. And really, the entire purpose of conducting an investigation is first and foremost to reveal whether any misconduct has occurred. And in terms of determining, obviously, whether or not misconduct has occurred, which specific employees are suspected or guilty of the misconduct, to then obviously stop the conduct and potentially issue any corrective action as a result. And in the event, let's say that the corrective action needs to go a bit further and potentially leads to termination of employment. It provides a sound factual basis for any decision made by management. So you're basically going to be able to clearly support your reason for either the discipline or the termination. And particularly, trust me, this does come up in termination discussions with counsel, whether or not an investigation was conducted and whether it was done properly to actually determine whether or not the results were correct or fair in the circumstances. And basically, then we can use that documentation to support that decision and any potential legal action against the company as a result. So very important. It's not that we're just trying to create work. We're basically going to create the foundation for the company to support your actions going forward.
So there's a legal duty to investigate. So as you see in the first point, employers that are subject to Ontario or federal legislation are statutorily required to investigate complaints raised under occupational health and safety legislation. So you actually have provisions in both the Ontario and the federal occupational health and safety legislation that compels employers to conduct investigations pursuant to that language in those statutes. But it doesn't stop there, really, although that's the statutorily required language is in that legislation. If you look at human rights legislation, in many situations, in order to minimize or mitigate the risk of a complaint by an employee, or even in the event of a complaint by the employee, if you have not conducted an investigation as an employer and have not conducted it properly, you're placing yourself in a situation where you may indeed attract significant liability. So ultimately, human rights legislation through the back door, or arguably not even the back door, the side door that's only a few feet from the front door, requires you to also conduct investigations. It also can be said that from a general health and safety perspective, the general duty on employers right across Canada in health and safety legislation is to take all precautions reasonable in the circumstances to protect the health and safety of employees. Well, if you have allegations or circumstances that suggest harassment, discrimination, potentially violence in the workplace, you're likely going to, or that likely will trigger the obligation to conduct an investigation to demonstrate that you're taking all reasonable precautions in the circumstances. If we look further in terms of company employee handbooks or collective agreements, we will often see provisions that set out complaint mechanisms and protocols for the investigation of complaints. And as you will see, we will discuss it in part later on, a failure to comply with your own policy can give rise to liability from an employer's perspective because you failed to comply with your own requirements that you've set out. And as we're going to discuss shortly as well, this area has evolved to the point where those that actually conduct the investigations may be subject, as scary as this is, to a duty to conduct it properly, which means if you fail to satisfy that duty or standard that an investigator ought to meet, then that investigator can actually be held liable. And as you see in that case that's identified, a recent case, and an inadequate investigation may give rise to a breach of the independently actionable duty of good faith. So that's actually saying, look, if you screw it up, company, right, the investigation, well, then that triggers another obligation that you have, employer, to act in good faith, and that means you screwed it up, and so you'll run afoul of that obligation of good faith. And ultimately, even if there is no legal duty in the circumstances, investigations are of significant importance in helping you as the employer support and defend the decisions that you make.
just going to delve briefly into Bill 132, which is relevant specifically for our Ontario-based clients, but it's important because it's a major change, and certainly we do expect that other provinces might be heading in this direction in the future as well. So Bill 132 was an amendment to the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which came into force on September 8, 2016. And it significantly bolsters an employer's obligation with regards to investigating claims, specifically Section 32.0.7 sub 1 sub A, requires an employer to investigate incidents and complaints of workplace harassment as appropriate in the circumstances. That's the key word there in this section. And that potentially means that even when no formal complaint has been made, the employer may in fact have a duty to investigate in the event that you as an employer become aware of an incident that may arise to harassment underneath occupational health and safety legislation. So it's certainly broader. We're not just talking formal now. We could also be talking informal or instances where, let's say, somebody comes to you and says, hey, I don't want to make a big issue out of this, but, you know, something happened. I just wanted to let somebody know. And if that something could potentially raise red flags as it relates to liability underneath occupational health and safety legislation, we may have to ask, notwithstanding what the employee wants in that circumstance. The other aspect that we're still trying to grapple with is the fact that Ministry of Labor inspectors now have the power to compel an investigation by an impartial third party into allegations of workplace harassment at the employer's expense. We are still getting clarification from the Ministry of Labor about this power, when it will be ordered, and what are we talking about with impartial third parties. So a couple of things we at least now know is that an impartial third party could be either an internal or external investigator. My inclination seems to think that most likely in a lot of instances it'll probably be external, which is obviously a significant cost to the company. However, we're still a bit unclear as to when it will be ordered. So the examples that we've provided on the slide actually come out of the Hansard, so basically the legislative debates that occurred in the Ontario legislation as to when they thought that an investigation might be ordered. So for example, you failed to conduct an investigation, or it's inadequate or improper. Or for example, maybe the Ministry of Labor has recently conducted a workplace inspection blitz and has determined that a further investigation to a particular incident might be necessary, or where an internal investigation may be ineffective or biased. In addition, Bill 132 now also requires that the investigation results be shared with the complainant and the alleged harasser. So going beyond just saying nowadays, oh, don't worry, we're dealing with it. Now, at the end of the investigation, the complainant is entitled to more information. Now, certainly, the legal community has discussed the fact that you don't necessarily need to produce a copy of the investigation report. That's not what's required. However, the complainant should at least be informed of any preventative measures, and specifically corrective action that has been taken against the alleged harasser. So in that instance, when we're talking about corrective actions, we're not necessarily delving into the specific level of discipline. So you're not required to say specifically it was a final written warning issued with a 3-day suspension. You would certainly need to inform them, however, the discipline has been issued, as well as, for example, what the company has been doing to correct any future, to ensure that any future incidents don't occur, whether or not an apology is forthcoming, et cetera. And as well, you now need to keep records for at least 1 year after the investigation. Certainly, we would probably recommend keep it a little bit longer, just given civil liability lasts for 2 years in Ontario. And as well, you don't need to worry about sharing the investigation results with your Joint Health and Safety Committee. That's not required yet, and certainly wouldn't be an additional step that we think that you should take. So certainly in Ontario, beware. You definitely have a more muddy legal landscape to wander through now when dealing with complaints underneath occupational health and safety legislation.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, and we often don't want to consider it in the context of conflict with employees generally, because of course we hope that doesn't arise, but just think about it for a second, and we'll probably touch on it later. But think about the leverage now an employee has, right? Because an employee at any given time now, assuming there's any credibility attached to a complaint of harassment, can immediately cause or trigger the employer to conduct some form of investigation. And what that also does for that employee is that the employee now has basically a halo above his or her head, wherein you can't take any action as the employer that would be considered a reprisal action against that employee for availing himself or herself of the provisions under Bill 132 or the amendments to the Occupational Health and Safety Act. So it's affording employees, to the extent they didn't already have it, significant leverage in circumstances where perhaps they want to abuse the rights that are available to them under the legislation. So let's talk about some of the ways an employer can get it wrong. And in particular, we've decided to list the top 10 mistakes for those of you who watch late night television. So number one, although I'm not sure it's necessarily in a particular order, failing to conduct the investigation promptly. Anytime you're conducting an investigation, you want the witnesses to have, let's call it their, what they have observed. You want to take advantage of those observations shortly after the event or events. The more time that goes by, the less likely they'll have an accurate recollection of the relevant events. So you want to do it promptly, not to mention, of course, the ramifications from, let's call it a human resources employee morale perspective, of permitting what is, let's assume, a genuine complaint of harassment sort of languish in the HR office and not be treated seriously and causing an investigation to be undertaken in a prompt fashion. Number two, disregarding procedural fairness. We are going to talk about that further, but of course, if you are going to undertake an investigation, and as you've already heard us identify, you need to conduct it in a manner that both protects as best you can the confidentiality of those involved, but you also need to ensure from a procedural perspective those that ought to be contributing to this exercise are, and that there is full disclosure, particularly to the respondent, of the particulars of the complaint. In the absence of that, you have an unfair investigation. And as you've heard us touch on moments ago, those responsible for conducting an unfair investigation can indeed even be liable for that unfairness, and certainly the company can be liable. Number three, selecting inappropriate investigators. If you select somebody with a bias, somebody who has absolutely no skill and ability as it relates to the conduct of an investigation, if you select somebody who will interrogate as opposed to investigate, who is going to be obnoxious, confrontational, that is not somebody that you want to be conducting the investigation. Failing to follow the company's own policies and procedures. We touched on that moments ago when we talked about the employee handbook, the collective agreement. As a company, you are always held to a high standard. That high standard typically includes the requirement that you, as the corporation, adhere to your own policies. A departure from those policies will not be perceived positively by any adjudicative body. Conducting a biased investigation. If you've decided on the result and conduct an investigation to achieve that result, that is a biased investigation and runs counter to the protocols of conducting a proper investigation. failing to gather all relevant information. Isn't that what an investigation is all about? Is gathering all relevant information and then making a reasoned determination based on that information. Ignoring confidentiality and privacy, right? These are sensitive matters that are often the subject of harassment complaints. And in order to properly conduct an investigation, you must, to the extent you can, it's not limitless, but to the extent you can, ensure those that are providing you with the information that they will enjoy a level of confidentiality and privacy. Failing to document the investigation and its findings. Well, ultimately, you need a written record. That written record will be extremely important in the Bill 132 context where an employee alleges the investigation was deficient. So in the absence of a report that properly sets it out, there is an opportunity for that officer from the Ministry of Labor to take the position that it was not done properly. Therefore, employer, as Aaron mentions, you will now have a third party conduct the investigation at your cost. And by the way, that third party loves interviewing no less than 20 employees at a time, so you can imagine the disruption in the workplace. Number 9, retaliation against the complainant or others. We mentioned that a few moments ago. The way legislation works under employment standards, under occupational health and safety legislation, certainly. The people that raise complaints are immediately in some kind of protected silo where you, as an employer, if you engage in any response or any action that is capable of being characterized as a reprisal action against that employee for having raised the complaint or even those that participate in the investigation, that will be seen as retaliation. And there is a very expeditious process, certainly in Ontario, to apply to the Ontario Labor Relations Board for full reinstatement and all back pay. So you have to bear that in mind. And then finally, number 10, failing to advise the complainant of the outcome and taking the remedial steps. I mean, the complainant has made the complaint. You need to tell the complainant, even if it's inconclusive or that there's no merit, there needs to be some finality attached to it. And certainly if remedial steps do have to be taken, this is all about doing it better ultimately on a go-forward basis.
So let's say you made one of those mistakes that Stu just went over. So what is the big deal? Why are we actually bothering to go through how to conduct this properly? Well, the bottom line really is that it increases your overall liability. So certainly, first and foremost, you can lose the ability to be able to argue that you have just cause for termination. All of a sudden now, we're talking about any potential notice or pay in lieu of notice that's owed to an employee, more dollars on your end. Breach of statutory duties. So if you do not conduct an investigation, and you should have underneath occupational health and safety legislation, that is in and of itself a breach of the act. And there are potential consequences that could come for that. There could be further liability for workplace torts. And what we mean by that is typically what ends up happening is, you know, whether or not there's mental distress that's associated with a failed investigation, which might potentially lead to punitive damages. And when we go through the cases on the next few slides, you will notice instances where courts are ordering large awards of aggravated and punitive damages where an investigation wasn't properly undertaken. You have, though, in addition to monetary liability, we always like to touch on the more HR-related aspects to these things, including how it's going to affect your overall workplace. And certainly, you're going to have lower employee morale and confidence in management. Now, all of a sudden, you become the bad guy. People aren't going to trust you. And potentially, in the future, when there is, you know, let's say, another serious incident, you may not become aware of it because people don't want to advise you of it because they feel like you won't do anything about it, which is obviously not what we want in the end, because we want a culture that's open and communicative and obviously respectful. There is also then a likelihood of everything else on the slide really relates to again, that increased liability that we talked about, so ministry officials investigating the workplace or ordering that external third party to come in, more dollars on your end. Legal actions, certainly, we've talked about that. Higher damages awards, again, those punitive and aggravated, those are going to be certainly alleged in these instances. And overall, just general damage to the reputation in the community. And the best example that I could give there is the CBC and Gian Gomeshi case, where people were coming forward with various allegations against him and how he was behaving in the workplace. And because he was one of their big stars, nobody did anything. And certainly CBC's name was in the paper, in the media constantly, and certainly they took a hit in terms of their reputation in the community, which is not something that any of us wants to go through. There leads to that in and of itself leads to further costs on your end. It could affect your ability to potentially recruit. And it certainly is a lot to recover from and trying to help you save face from. So certainly there's related costs that we want to avoid.
Yeah, and you know, that's a great point that Aaron raises about, you know, CBC certainly not acting, not acting properly. They didn't act at all, right? And look, at the end of the day, nobody's telling you what your ultimate determination ought to be and the remedial steps that you have to take. But what you need to do is at least be seen to be conducting an investigation where it's appropriate and taking some step. And maybe with Gomeshi, the star of CBC, those remedial steps would have to some degree been deficient, but at least it would have gone a long way had they conducted an appropriate investigation, made a determination that, all right, there has been inappropriate conduct in one way, shape, or form. Here's the remedial action, maybe less than perfect in the circumstances, but that is a far better result where reasonable people will disagree on what the remedial steps should be than having completely turned a blind eye to it and then having, as Aaron correctly describes, having that, you know, that black mark on the reputation of CBC, at least as it relates to its internal HR operations. So, you know, further examples, as it were, of getting it wrong, and they're all over the place, right? This is an Alberta decision where you've got a long service employee terminated for allegations regarding sexual harassment without a proper investigation. And although the investigation was conducted, it included such deficiencies as failing to disclose the particulars of the complaint. Well, if you're going to make an allegation about my conduct, surely I'm entitled to know what the particulars are of that conduct in order to permit me to properly defend myself. And remember, one of the key elements we talked about earlier was procedural fairness. So a respondent, which is the term that's often used to describe the person who's the complainant is complaining about, is entitled to have that information. In this case, the suspended employee, when asked what the accusations were against them, right, they didn't give him the information and just basically said, you're gone on suspension. And there was also complications here about advising the son and embarrassing the father that he was accused of sexual harassment without the father knowing all the details, right? And in the circumstances where it's already a deficient investigation and dad says, hey, I'd like to have counsel present for my interview because this is not going right, of course, they refuse that, and that to some extent exacerbated the whole situation. By the way, we don't want to send the message that an employee is necessarily entitled to counsel. That's not the case. But in some circumstances, it can be the right decision. Once again, depending on the circumstances. Well, now let's take a look at what happens to the company's wallet as it relates to the deficient investigation. Well, the employee ended up being entitled to 24 months reasonable notice. So you're talking about the wrongful dismissal element, right? Right, so he gets 24 months reasonable notice. He gets punitive damages. And punitive damages is when the court says, we are so dismayed, party, employer in this case, by your conduct, that we are going to punish you by making an award that will act in part as a deterrent to the world at large, so that no other party engages in the kind of conduct you engaged in. $75,000 is a big number for punitive damages, and also damages for defamation against the two accusers. So these people had an agenda. Of course, we couldn't go through all the detail here, but those people had an agenda, and there were damages for defamation. And the court was clear in identifying that this particular employee, Mr. Elgert, would have also been entitled, had he been able to produce the appropriate medical supporting documentation, of $200,000, right, in connection with what are called aggravated damages. But as a result of the absence of that supporting information, that was overturned. But take a look at those numbers. They're big.
So just another example here, because as Stu indicated, our examples are many and varied across the country. So here in this case, it's a decision of the BC Supreme Court. A manager with 30 years of service was accused of bullying and harassment, which led to an investigation. And essentially, the big downfall of this investigation was that the company carried it out already assuming that the manager was guilty. They did not go in with an open mind, as we're going to chat about later on in the slides, and basically determined that the manager was at fault. And as a result, everything that they did in the investigation was with a view to proving the manager guilty. So they went in and any witnesses that supported the manager were accused of lying. The manager was subject to intense interrogation. And when writing their report, the conclusions weren't supported by the evidence. So certainly in some instances, the manager acknowledged that some allegations were true. However, in the report, the employer just said denied it all, which obviously makes the employee look way worse in terms of when you deny something as opposed to showing remorse or admitting certain faults looks better on the employee. So certainly here, the company was just trying to cross the T's, dot the I's, make the employee look as bad as they possibly can on paper, and to be able to allege just cause. Well, certainly the court found that the company did not have just cause, awarded 18 months notice, which actually is on the lower end, given that the manager did have 30 years of service, and did award $35,000 in aggravated damages specifically related to the unfair investigation. So again, additional damages being levied against a company purely because of a failure in this case to conduct an investigation properly. And then as well, there was another element where the company was trying to essentially hold a letter of reference hostage, and then there was punitives awarded against the company for that as well. So obviously, again, the key thing that we're going to be going over when getting it right is you have to go into these things with an open mind. If you find that yourself, you're not going to be able to go into it and keep an open mind, maybe that's an instance where you need to remove yourself from an investigation and appoint a different person. Again, Stu will be going over this in terms of appointing the appropriate investigator and who that could be, but that might be an instance where find somebody else in your company, or if there's nobody else, you are the one and only HR person, then maybe that's a good time to go external.
This one, I'm just going to focus on what the key point is in this Quebec case, but take a look at the first noted fact circumstance. A teacher of 14 years was the subject of a psychological harassment complaint made by two employees. The employer retained an external investigator to handle the investigation. Well, as it turns out, that external investigator doesn't even follow the internal corporate policy as it relates to investigations, which we mentioned a few moments ago. So what happens? If you look at the final point that's indicated on that slide, the court held that the investigator was under a duty to conduct the investigation fairly. The court further found several violations of the duty of procedural fairness, we mentioned that before, including lack of disclosure to the employee respecting key information, preventing him from fully responding to the complaint, We mentioned that before in the top mistakes. Providing little notice when scheduling investigation meetings with the employee, clearly something that ought to be done for a fair investigation, and failing to clearly outline evidence in the final report. Oh, it's rather selective then, I guess, in terms of drafting the report. But here's what's interesting. The court awarded $3,000 against the investigator for the poor investigation. So the actual investigator, the third party who came in to conduct the investigation, was held liable by the court for the deficiencies in the investigation. That's pretty amazing stuff.
So this next case was pretty scary when it first came out for employers located in Ontario, in part because it was the Human Rights Tribunal essentially finding and holding the company liable for simply failing to conduct an investigation when there for an improper investigation, rather, when the actual allegations underlying the investigations the investigation were dismissed. So in this case, the employee had known vision problems and made a complaint with respect to discrimination on the basis of disability. And essentially, the company conducted an improper investigation, but found essentially that there was no merits to the complaint. The tribunal did agree that there was, in fact, no merit to the underlying discrimination piece, so that there was no actual incidence of discrimination, but still found against the company as a result of the failure on behalf of the company as it related to the investigation aspect. And certainly that's scary when you're talking, okay, here we don't even have an instance of workplace discrimination, and yet you can still be held liable. Well, since then, we have found that this case hasn't been followed, but just by way of note, this case was never officially overturned, even though the tribunals haven't been following it. So who knows? Maybe new life will be breathed into it into the future. But for now, fingers crossed that they keep it to what the tribunal has been following since then.
And that case that Aaron just, you know, reviewed with you is really, really, when you think about it, it's really interesting. I mean, think about it. There is no merits to the complaint, but the tribunal still held, because you didn't do an investigation properly, we're going to hold you liable. It's a remarkable finding by a tribunal, and it just shows you, even though, as Aaron mentioned, it's not really being followed by subsequent tribunals, but it underscores, and this is the point, that investigations are so fundamental, and the manner in which you conduct them so important that you conduct them properly, that in this particular case we were talking about, the tribunal actually held, oh, employer, you didn't do anything wrong, but yeah, the investigation you conducted wasn't done well, so we're going to find you liable. It just shows you how remarkable, how important the investigation process is. Okay, Boucher and Walmart, you may have heard about it. It's a rather well-known decision. And she was just treated so poorly. It's just beyond belief how poorly she was treated. The bottom line is essentially they ignored much of what she said. They breached their own policy. The company, you know, in a very sort of cursory manner, virtually concluded her allegations were unsubstantiated. And not only that, found that she was trying to undermine her supervisor, right? The company just ignored numerous incidents of her being berated by the supervisor in front of coworkers. Right, and they didn't even extend their investigation to relevant witnesses. It was just a complete botched effort, perhaps by design, to conduct an investigation. Right, and if that wasn't bad enough, the company informed the employee that she would be held accountable for making the complaint, right, although they weren't sure what the discipline would be. So she says, I've had enough of this after a final incident of abusive conduct. Because I can't take this anymore, and alleges constructive dismissal. Take a look at the numbers. It's a jury trial where she's alleging constructive dismissal and, of course, raising these issues of abusive conduct. And the jury awards damages of $1.2 million against Walmart, $200,000 in what are called aggravated damages, and take a look at that next number, $1 million in punitive damages. That's punitive. It's not to compensate the aggrieved party, the plaintiff, the employee. It's saying your conduct, Walmart, was so outrageous that we're going to assign a $1 million value to that. Now, of course, she also got 20 weeks salary in accordance with her employment agreement. And take a look what happened to the supervisor, the individual supervisor, $250,000 against the supervisor, allocated as follows, $100,000 in aggravated damages and $150,000 in punitive damages. There's that punitive again. Now, this, of course, goes to appeal. The court upholds the following damages. So there's still $100,000 against the supervisor for intentional infliction of mental distress or the aggravated damages, and $200,000 against Walmart for aggravated damages. So that's upheld. Now, on appeal, the court reduces a couple of these numbers, but still big numbers in the employment sphere. Punitive damages against the supervisor went from $150,000 to $10,000, and punitive damages against Walmart went from $1 million to $100,000. But these numbers should signal to everyone how the courts perceive this area.
So I think we've kind of hit you over the head with how bad this can possibly be if we do it wrong. So how do we do this right? And essentially from here on out, we're going to give you the framework which you should follow to ensure that the investigation that you complete is one that you can stand behind, one that will support your decisions, and one that will certainly be of assistance to you in the event of any litigation. So why don't we just dive right into it and go to the first steps, determine if an investigation is necessary.
Okay, so let's look at this key element. Investigation certainly can be a response to a complaint or at the election of the company based on what it's observing. And as Aaron pointed out, Bill 132, yeah, you're going to have that duty if what you see should give rise to the conduct of an investigation. So what are some of the reasons why an employer would conduct an investigation? Obviously, the form of complaint or grievance. If you see discrimination, right, very serious. Harassment, violence, or threats of violence, obviously extremely serious. You want to determine what's going on. An employee's morale, behavior, attitude, or performance declines. Why, if you see something that's an aberration, right, of a long-standing employee that's a good employee, something's not right. Maybe there's something that needs to be investigated. Clearly, misconduct, theft, vandalism, violations of work rules, safety problems, all situations that may cause you to look beyond, let's call it, the individual incident, as it were, and maybe it requires a more fulsome investigation.
So once you determine that the investigation is necessary, we have to determine the scope. So in other words, the frame of the investigation. What are we really looking into? And essentially, this information is going to help determine the appropriate steps for the investigator and essentially tell them their mandate. So first of all, what's the nature of the incident? Is it on-duty or off-duty conduct? Who was involved? Is discipline a possibility? Start getting those sorts of ideas in your mind as it relates to what actually are we talking about. Then we also need to determine our statutory obligations to determine what standards apply. And typically in this case, for example, if it's about a breach of company policy, we need to be reviewing those policies so that when we come up with a decision in the end, we're always referring back to them. Particularly as it relates to the statutory obligations, there are definitions for, you know, harassment, sexual harassment, discrimination, and violence. And those are what the investigators should be looking at and referring to when determining, making any determinations or writing their investigation report. Determining if there's statutory obligations involved also helps us start to think about who's an appropriate investigator, because you certainly want the investigator to have some sort of familiarity with any potential statutory obligations that you as an employer are subject to. And then last but not least, if you are in a unionized environment, you need to think about collective agreement considerations, because we tell this to all of our unionized clients. If you as an employer fail to follow any procedural elements that are required by the collective agreement, any decision that you make as it relates to that particular employee is going to be overturned by an arbitrator. So if you want your decision to be upheld at arbitration, because most likely if it involves an investigation, we're probably going to arbitration over it, you need to make sure that there is no procedural fault. So at least on that element, you're safe.
Okay, our number three is select the appropriate investigator, right? And these are the characteristics that you want in the investigator. Credible, respected, regarded as impartial and fair. Obviously, right? We don't want a perception of bias. Not involved with the employee or employees on a personal level. Clearly, we want somebody who's distanced, who's, there's no real connection, right? Non-arm's length, as it were. Not involved in the incident, clearly. We don't want that person, who, in effect, who's a witness to the incident being an investigator. Knowledge about company policies, employment law, right? Aaron just touched on that, right? We need somebody who has some wherewithal in this area. Somebody who has good interviewing skills and good communication skills, because ultimately you're sitting down in a room and asking questions. And so you need to have that ability to communicate. Well organized, able to develop and follow a plan. Ultimately, you want this investigation to be conducted in an orderly fashion and ultimately the report to reflect that. A good witness in court, if it finds itself there, then you want that person to be able to provide the court with a very credible history of the events. Trustworthy, right? With confidential information. It ought not be somebody who wants to leak it out because they enjoy that process or they want to favor certain people. Human resources staff or higher level managers, right? We want the people that are capable of doing this, right? If the situation requires confidentiality, a significant level of it, or there's a possibility of bias, or the circumstances are so unique that it lends itself to the retention of an outside third party investigator or consultant, fine, right? And then ultimately experts in technical matters, if technical issues are involved, that's helpful. But look at that last point. 99% of the time, the investigation can be done in-house. And we always make that recommendations to our clients. So don't, you know, it's become an industry now, investigations. And so you have third parties soliciting their wares, as it were, to say, you need me, you need me, you need me. No, you don't. You absolutely do not. And there's a myriad of reasons that we don't have the time to get into now why you want it done internally. But trust us, you want it done internally where you can.
Now, for our federally regulated clients, it's important to note that when somebody makes a complaint underneath the workplace violence regulation underneath the Canada Labor Code, you must appoint a competent person to investigate. And specifically, what workplace violence means is any action, conduct, threat, or gesture of a person towards an employee or his or her workplace that can be reasonably expected to cause harm, injury, or illness. And just so you know, there has been decisions that indicate that that definition of workplace violence is broad enough to potentially encompass harassment. So while the Canada Labor Code doesn't have a specific requirement as it relates to harassment, it's being now found underneath this requirement of workplace violence. So when we're talking in this instance about appointing a competent person, who is that? Well, essentially it has to be impartial by both parties. And that case that's noted on that slide there is specifically about what happens when the complainant doesn't find the person to be impartial. In that instance, a manager was appointed to do the investigation, and the employee didn't think that the manager was going to be impartial. And as a result, the federal court eventually found that it wasn't a complete investigation because the investigator was not a competent person underneath the Canada Labor Code regulations. So they need to be impartial. It's very crucial. And then obviously, as basically what Stu already went over in terms of being knowledgeable, trained, and experienced in issues relating to that particular area, including any relevant legislation. So certainly underneath the Canada Labor Code, you do have this heightened requirement there about the fact that both parties must view the person as a competent person to investigate.
Somebody asked a great question. If the complainant is a witness and wants to remain anonymous, can we respect their wishes? That is a great question. I can give you the short answer is, as we talked about before, the respondent is entitled to a fair procedural process, which includes the particulars of the complaint and, in all likelihood, the identity of the complainant. But that's not to say you can't, as a result of that information, I would say conduct a general investigation depending on the nature of what that issue is. So there can be a way of having a more generalized approach where you're not specifically setting out who the respondent is and who the complainant is to try to see if there is a generalized problem in the workplace that you're going to try to remedy. So obviously much depends on the particular facts, but there are options as to how do you approach these situations. Number four, preparing for the investigation. We're going to talk like we're from New York now because in the interest of time, you want to act promptly, right? You want to determine whether you have to do something on an interim basis, right? So depending on the nature of the allegations, you know, you may have to transfer the respondent or the complainant, the respondent to do different areas so they don't come in contact with each other, particularly where it's sexual harassment or alleged violence, right? In most cases, you're not going to change the working conditions of the alleged wrongdoer because there's a presumption of innocence, right? You typically want to approach it on that basis, right? But where there's a concern for safety, certainly, you may even want to think of a paid leave of absence for that respondent because of the nature of the allegations. So it's all going to depend on the circumstances, but think you may have to act on an interim basis. You always need to identify who the witnesses and the documents are going to be in order to conduct an investigation properly. Similarly, in our number four, preparing for the investigation, you want to organize a list of questions, right? So, you know, it's not rocket science. We all know about who, what, when, where, why, right? So ultimately, really, that's what you're doing. What did the witness see or hear? When and where? Who else was there? Basic information that we need to gather. You typically want to start with generalized questions, repeat important questions. You may ultimately move to more focused questions in due course. See if the witness is saying anything inconsistent. Do not be confrontational or accusatory, right? You are not cross-examining as a lawyer those who want to be lawyers. Number one, we'd ask you why. But if you get past, we get past that, you know, you don't want to be playing that role. You're just gathering information. But you do want to ask the tough questions and be ready with follow-up questions.
Now, in terms of conducting interviews, because we have covered off quite a number of these already in our discussion, I'm going to hit the highlights. But what I find when talking to our clients the most is that this is the area that clients dread the most. They can do all the prep work. They can definitely throw together the report. But to conduct an interview, that seems to be the most scary element. So what can we do here to help alleviate those concerns? Well, first and foremost, we're going to recommend an order of the interview. So first, typically it's the complainant and the complainant's witnesses to ensure we have all the questions we need when talking with the respondent. And then obviously the respondent may also have their own witnesses. So after you talk to the respondent, make sure you follow up with their witnesses. And then depending upon how the conversation goes, you may have to follow up with certain people who you've already interviewed. And again, just making sure here that when you're conducting the interviews themselves, you want to make sure that you, when you're drafting those questions, that you are allowing them to meaningfully respond as you just went over, as well as making sure that when you're setting up for the interview generally, you're taking into consideration any issues relating to cultural, gender, racial, medical, or language issues that might be an issue that may require an additional person in the room to assist that person, because certainly our duty to accommodate could certainly extend to this area. And definitely when conducting interviews, your notes are key. Take good notes. 100%. This is what we're going to be using to write that report. Without good notes, we don't have much to go on. Hold the interview in a private and quiet location. Sometimes my clients want to take somebody offsite to a coffee shop because they feel like it's less intimidating, but in the end, that's not an appropriate location to be having those discussions. Do it in a private, quiet location. And certainly, again, all of this relates to, you know, how we end up having this discussion. Key thing being is that you're going in with an open mind. You're not trying to mislead the respondent. And certainly we're trying to gather all the facts. So sometimes if that includes obtaining a written statement, that can be very helpful, typically as well if it's from the respondent and the complainant. And certainly if you're conducting the investigation and you're finding you're hitting a wall and somebody's not wanting to answer your questions, you certainly can advise them that failure to comply with a reasonable request to answer questions could constitute insubordination and can be ground for obviously discipline up to and including termination of employment. So certainly something to note there.
Okay, under our point number 5. Use silence after a question, right? You don't have to have a nonstop talking, right? You don't want to interrupt witnesses, right? You want to hear what they have to say, right? Don't be judgmental. Don't give the impression you don't want to hear them, right? So that's the idea. That's the idea. Let them talk. And look, there are other techniques, and we could go into, well, you know, a lot. You can pay, you know, take the opportunity to read some of this, but the idea is don't let, you know, you want to challenge them a little, right? Did you take the money? And they say, oh, why would I take the money? No, no. Did you take the money? No, just yes or no, right? Right? And, you know, you also want to, and I'm going to jump down a little when somebody expresses indignation about a question. That's one of the areas that you'll always notice if you're involved in this area quite a bit when you say, you know, when you ask the question and then that person says, oh, what kind of question is that? I won't even dignify that question with an answer. Well, there's a likelihood there's something that person's hiding, right? Right? And so don't let them be hypothetical. Ask them to give you the specific information, right? Don't accept, oh, I usually do this or I usually do this. No. What did you do yesterday? That's what I want to know.
And other potential indications that somebody's trying to get around answering a question is answers such as, that's a tough question, that's a hard one, may give an indication that they're not being credible. Or alternatively, a slip of the tongue when they're saying, oh, you got me confused, I actually meant this. We would take that to mean that's actually what the employee meant to say, not that it was in fact an accident. And last but not least, we would always say end the interview by saying, is there anything else you think I should know? Leave it open and see what they say, because sometimes you don't know what could potentially pop up in those conversations.
Right. Review the evidence. Right. If you have to consult with an expert regarding the findings, obviously we're here. So you're going to work closely with us, and that's obviously going to largely facilitate the whole process. Direct evidence is better. If I say this is what I saw versus this is what somebody told me they saw, the former is much better. You're going to assess credibility. You're entitled to do that. If you don't believe John and you believe Sally, well, so be it. Then Sally's evidence is preferred, right? And you're going to want to determine if there are gaps and if you need to follow up as a result of those gaps.
We've obviously also gone over the importance of preparing an investigation report. It's a key document. For any of you who need help with this, 100% reach out to us. We can assist you with this. But certainly, essentially, you're going to be going through everything that you covered in the investigation, describing the issue, list the witnesses and documents, and then make those determinations that Stu just went over.
I'm going to drop down in number 8 to the last one. Right? Is the complaint substantiated, unsubstantiated, or is the investigation inconclusive? That latter finding, that it's inconclusive, is perfectly permissible and, quite frankly, is often not that you're not going to make the finding that the facts scream out for, but inconclusive is often a very good compromise. You're not denying the legitimacy of the claim, nor are you denying, in effect, the response of the respondent. So that often will be the appropriate outcome.
And then last but not least, you've conducted your investigation, you have your conclusion, now you need to inform the relevant parties. And so certainly we need to conduct the discipline if it's necessary, conduct relevant training if we think that's the right step, as well as when notifying the parties, obviously if it's unsubstantiated or inconclusive, we want to be able to explain to the complainant why, and certainly encourage them to come forward in the event of any future allegations. We don't want them to feel like we won't hear them again in the future.
So with respect to our closing thoughts, right, if you've done the job properly, then the company's going to have a solid basis foundation for taking action and ultimately, if required, defend itself against claims of inaction or unfair treatment. You've done your job, right? Also bear in mind, even if you do your job properly, of course, employees have the opportunity to seek recourse through government agencies, tribunals, courts, etc. And of course, they're entitled to do that. The fact that you've conducted a sound investigation is going to help defending against such external complaints. So all in all, right, it is a challenge to undertake, but a necessity. And so understand it requires significant effort to do it properly, but of course we're here and with our assistance, you will conduct it properly and be in a very, very good position down the road. So with that, we thank you all for attending on our session today. We look forward to seeing you on June the 21st. And I'm specifically extending thanks to Aaron for putting this all together and educating me on the area. So thanks all of you, and we'll see you soon.